You are listening to The Operative Word, a podcast brought to you by the Journal of the American College of Surgeons. I'm Dr. Lillian Erdahl, and throughout this series, Dr. Tom Verghese and I will speak with recently published authors about the motivation behind their latest research and the clinical implications it has for the practicing surgeon. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not necessarily that of the American College of Surgeons. Welcome back to the Operative Word podcast. My name is Lillian Erdahl. I am one of your co-hosts, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Amy Hernandez, who is with the Department of Surgery at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego. Welcome to the Operative Word.
No, thank you, Dr. Erdahl. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
Well, I am excited to hear more about the history of women surgeons at sea as we discuss your article, Anchors Away. Tell me a little bit about, you know, kind of the inspiration for sharing this work and what started you and your co-authors and looking into this.
Well, my co-author, Dr. Tadlock, him and I, he's been a mentor and a guide for me as I've been going through my career. And when I graduated from residency, I got 1 week off and immediately went out to the USS Carl Vinson and for a workup for several weeks. And then we came home and immediately went on deployment. And my experiences there in kind of the preparatory journey and then the subsequent deployment led to me wanting to fix the world because I just felt like everything, like similar to many other military experiences not related to surgery or medicine, everything was like the first time it's ever happened before, even though it's not. And so initially he encouraged me to write an article to be submitted to military medicine on, you know, how to prepare for a military surgery deployment. And then we took it one step further and we co-authored a book or co-edited a book on expeditionary surgery at sea. And it's written by everyone from surgical technologists and laboratory technologists up to surgeons who have gone and done multiple maritime deployments, which is really cool. Everyone, a real breadth of experience and everyone being able to offer their stuff. And so the first of its kind. And so in working together on that, we talked a lot about women. And it's one of my passions. I started a women in surgery lectureship here. And so he knows that's something that I'm really interested in. And so then we were just talking about what parts of it were gender-based and not gender-based and just kind of, he's very good at coming up with ideas. He's excellent at it. And I'm very good at doing menial labor and looking up things. And so then, which is how we wrote our book together. He would have a grand plan and then I would go and scurry around and do grammatical edits to make sure that things looked okay and that the tables made sense. And so it was in part, I am part of the article and I'm part of the history, but then like, how did it all start? And how far we've come. And around that time, the article talks about, you know, from the start to where we are. And like at one point we had a 50% fill rate, even though only 30% of us our surgeons, so we're more than representing our population, and that's pretty awesome.
Yeah,
a very long answer to your question. I'm sorry.
No, it's awesome, and I loved reading about the history of women, not just in the U.S. Navy, but on ships and in naval medicine, and how far it goes back. So tell us kind of the early history of women in medicine and surgery, at sea.
Yeah, thank you. We chose not to focus on all the women in medicine and women in surgery that has been written about a lot, which is amazing and fantastic. And everyone listening to this should go and read about all those amazing women. We did highlight three women, Mary Edwards Walker in America, and Dr. James Barry, who ended up being Dr. Miranda Stewart, found after death in Great Britain, and Princess Vera Gedroyts in Russia. And they were all the first women surgeons in their respective countries, and they were all affiliated with the military. And so we highlighted them very briefly just to say that they were groundbreaking, and the military was kind of how they started in each of their countries. And then when we started talking, There's not a lot about women in medicine or surgery at all through a lot of history. And then in the like 1600s and 1700s, it was just not possible for women to get an education in surgery and go on a ship. Like, women were not on ships. It just didn't exist.
Both of those things were difficult for women, right? Women weren't welcomed into the profession, and they were seen to be a liability or simply not to belong on ships, is kind of how I understand it.
Exactly. And so there was just no way to overcome both of those barriers. And so the few women who were described as people who were spouses and then were on deployments, but they were not allowed to be paid. And then they usually were assisting, so more in a nursing role, but in surgical cases. And so the one that we referenced was Nellie Giles. And so there's records of her helping with all of the casualties on the HMS Bellerophon. And she was in her third trimester when she did that, which is pretty remarkable. And so that was the initial start of women helping with surgical care at sea. And then in the 1800s, which is such a cool era and what we were partially focused on in our article, Mary Stickney is an example of where captain's wives with absolutely no education at all were providing the medical care for the entire crew on their ships that their spouses were captaining. And so she was on a whaling vessel, the Cicero, and there are pictures of her like with a parrot on her shoulder and descriptions of her. And so in one of our figures, we have her handwritten diary entries of the people that were injured, what their injuries are and what she did for them. It sounds like she was quite no nonsense, but well respected by the crew. And it's pretty fantastic that she took care of like a gaff hook to the foot.
Wow.
With no training, whereas a gaff hook to the foot would intimidate probably all of us, no matter how well trained we were.
Well, and I imagine, you know, even today, one of the things you mentioned was in expeditionary surgery, how do we prepare? Trying to imagine these women and, you know, what supplies they did or didn't have, and how they improvised in austere environments without resources. When I think about the barriers in front of her trying to provide that care, you know, lack of experience, lack of supplies, lack of expectation of getting to a port where maybe there would be more resources.
Yeah, because that's not happening. There's no helicopters flying it on. It's just nothing, which is, and even now, and that's a lot of what we did talk about in the book, doing surgery at sea, even now, it's very, in some ways, it's very similar to doing other surgery. And our book really didn't focus on a lot of surgical technique, because there's lots of other textbooks for that. But it was really more focusing on, you know, you are probably used to being in a operating room where things exist. And you're probably, even in residency, you're not even part of ordering them. Like, they just exist. And then as a staff, you become more involved in the ordering and, you know, what you want and your case card. And then you go out there and it's a whole bunch of people who probably haven't done this ever. Or if they have, they haven't done it here. And you're in charge and you haven't done it. And everything you're expecting isn't a thing. And the supply thing, it came up with the surgical techs and it came up with the nurses and it came up with anesthesia and it came up with the surgeons talking about stuff like the supply chain, talking about stuff like, well, and then what are you going to do with your patient afterwards? There are ICUs, but there's one critical care nurse for every single patient. And so like if there was a mass casualty, that's very different than if it's just one surgical patient that I'm dropping off with my critical care nurse who needs to sleep sometime.
What do you imagine these women like, Dr. Stewart, who of course was known as Dr. Barry at the time, or, you know, how did they manage? I imagine the mortality rates were higher and, you know, just thinking about someone in the 1800s recovering from sepsis, you know, if it happened from a injury from a dirty implement at sea. I mean, how can we draw inspiration or maybe gratitude that we often do work with more resources?
I think that that is a great way to think about it, and to also have a realistic expectation. A lot more people died back then, and it was acceptable. Whereas here, I can do something on the ship, and there's an M&M process now for me to submit my stuff. It's not in the moment, but my case will be presented by a greater governing body to make sure that I'm providing standard of care out at sea. And so, like, if I were to just be like, nah, they didn't make it, that would not fly. And so I think that drawing inspiration from people thinking outside the box and being able to take care of people under such austere and difficult circumstances is remarkable, but also acknowledging that they lived in a different time when, like, guillotine amputations were, like, standard of care instead of absolutely not something you should say on your oral boards ever. And so
it is remarkable to think over, 100 years, how much the practice of medicine and surgery has changed. You know, some of the women that you talk about being on ships, again, not always as surgeons, but on the Mississippi, during the American Civil War, it brings to mind, what would it be like? I mean, it just sort of takes us back to what would it be like to be on a ship during the Civil War? And then I wonder, what maybe has not changed. So tell me about when women were allowed to serve at sea in the U.S. Navy and kind of how, that came to be and what that looks like.
Of course. Yeah. I think women weren't allowed on combatant vessels, medical or otherwise, because of congressional law. And so women started joining the military and then joining the reserves and joining active duty, then going on ships like hospital ships, which is where women were traditionally serving in maritime roles. And so and then women joined the military as surgeons. I think I pulled up my article to make sure that I got the right year. The Dr. Judy Ellen Schwartz joined in 1971, and then she completed residency in 1976. And then it wasn't until the law was fully repealed. So in 1993, women were allowed to serve on combatant vessels. And then it wasn't until 1997 that one of our female surgeons in the military actually went on a vessel, and that was Dr. Beth Jaklick. And we got a chance to interview her, Dr. Tadlock and I, which was pretty neat to interview the first women surgeon to ever go on a ship. And she's pretty fantastic and really groundbreaking. She was also, we talked about it in the article a little bit, she was the first female general medical officer to ever serve with the United States Marine Corps. So she was first in a lot of different ways. And so what I was struck by actually the most in her interview was that her experience was pretty much like mine. I was a bit of a novel figure when I went there in 2016-17 timeframe. I was a little novel. People were surprised. They thought I was a nurse, which is not unique to being on a ship. On the surgeon moms group, that's a pretty commonly represented sentiment. And so I was novel, but I wasn't disrespected. It was pretty much the same for her. People were like, well, I mean, if you can do your job, then welcome. And it's kind of weird that you're a woman, but I guess if you can do it, you can do it. And she took care of the same breadth of cases that I took care of. And so I was in the interview, I was the most struck by how similar our experiences were in their challenges, because she struggled with having access to resources. I had struggled with access to resources. People now still struggle with access to resources. And so that was both encouraging and interesting to me. And then her description of just how it was more challenging and remarkable for her to have been the first person to go with the Marine Corps was interesting to me as well.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting to me just to hear the parallels again in my lived experience and the experiences that I hear from a lot of other women surgeons in particular and women physicians, which is surprising to me that in 1997 we finally had the first woman, you know, on a combatant vessel. I mean, it always struck me that we hadn't come as far as I expected at so many of the steps along the way. And it's whether you're the first or the second, it takes time to change the culture. And it can be daunting that the onus is on the person who has been excluded or who represents the excluded group to change, as opposed to on all of those who are already there to be welcoming. And it sounds like you found that people were welcoming, but it took a little adjustment period. I mean, I think it's still disappointing to me that people's first assumption is based on their bias and their past experience, instead of assuming that you're the doctor. And it's both a small thing and a large thing, because it is not intentional necessarily, but when you have to explain for 20 minutes, 10 times a day, who you are, it's a lot of mental energy, and it takes away time that you could spend actually doing your job. So, you know, it's Dr. Jacklick maybe made an impression on the ship she was on, but not necessarily across the entire, you know, U.S. fleet, unfortunately.
I agree. Yeah, I was surprised that it was not until the 1990s. Like, I had been born and women were not on combatant ships. Yeah. And that's amazing to me. And that even it took 4 more years after women were allowed on combatant ships for a woman surgeon to go on one. Although that probably is more representative of how many women were a part of the surgical community at that time. But yeah, I think kind of the death by 1,000 paper cuts is present everywhere. At one moment on my last deployment, because I've had the opportunity to deploy again since my Carl Vinson time. And on that deployment, I was called down to the medical department because some person wanted to know why I wasn't, me and my team weren't going to another vessel to do their mission. And so this wasn't a boss. This was someone the boss had tasked to figure out information. And so I went down and I was polite and explained what was going on and kind of how requests for medical personnel work and the different types of maritime surgical teams there are, and how I was part of a fleet surgical team. And the guy kept pushing, even though he's not medical, he's not in the Navy and not part of any of these teams, just kept pushing and pushing. And so finally I laid my trump card and was like, okay, well, if you would like to know more about it, there's a book about all of this, all of surgery at sea. It's called Expeditionary Surgery at Sea, and it is in publication right now. You can access the PDF journal articles online for the chapters. He's like, oh, that's so interesting. How do you know about it? I'm like, I wrote it. And so then he was quiet. And I didn't get asked any more this is called knife handing. He was like knife handing me in the hallway. And I'm like, I don't understand what's going on right now. Like, I'm the subject matter expert here, not you. And so after that, he ceased his knife handing, and it wouldn't have reflected well on the medical profession or me to have talked him down or been as impolite to me or him as he was being to me. But it was just like that's an example of just, I'm like, I know more here than you. So please, I'm happy to relay it to anyone. I didn't even say I wouldn't do what they were asking me to do. I just wanted them to do it the appropriate way. So, yes. Yeah, but then there were plenty of people who deferred to me completely, just as they would if I was a man. And so we tried to also address that in our paper and say that a lot of the stuff is gender agnostic. It's not the challenges of being at sea. While some of them might be because I was a woman, most of them are because it's just challenging to do surgery at sea, no matter who you are.
Yeah. And it strikes me that you had the grace to remain calm and, you know, entertain the questions in that scenario for so long as well. And I think, you know, that's certainly what I hear from leaders in general, right? Is, you know, trying to manage your emotions through any challenging situation or conflict. But also, I think I hear, especially from, you know, women in surgery, which is, you know, how much energy they expend trying to moderate their behavior so that it doesn't reflect badly both on their profession and on their gender. Or, you know, if we think about, you know, people who have multiple identities that are historically not represented in surgery, you know, it can be so hard sometimes to be the one or the first and feel this burden that your behavior might reflect on anyone else who is perceived as being similar to you because of identity characteristics. And hopefully, you know, that's not too much of a burden, but it can certainly feel like one and be a part of that experience, I think, of being the first or being early in whatever you're pioneering.
Agreed. Yeah. And on my most recent deployment, our executive officer, and then she became our commanding officer, so the second in command, then going to the first command when the first in command moves on, was a woman. And then our operations officer, she was a woman, and I was a woman, and like we had a couple other prominent people who were women. And so for Women's History Month, the XO, her CO at that time, she just said a couple words, but then the OPSO, she was taking the bench kind of, because she introduced the whole event, and she's like, there shouldn't be remarkable. Everyone is remarkable. Like, there should be no more firsts. And so I was like, I'm taking a different approach. I'm celebrating the firsts for women. But then in the end, both of us ended up doing the same thing without planning it together. And I think that both of those are right. I think it's right to be like, we shouldn't have firsts anymore because we should be working towards normalcy. And also celebrating the people that went before us, which is part of what this article was. The women... I had, I think, such a smooth experience because all these other people worked really hard for me to have a smooth experience. And I'm really grateful for them because then I wouldn't have ever gotten to crawl around the nuclear reactor of a carrier. Like, that's a really neat, unique experience that not a lot of people can say they've done. And I was able to do that, and I was able to care for people, the men and women that I was deployed with, which is an honor to do it anytime, but especially at sea in a unique environment because of all those people who went before me and made my journey not as hard. And so part of the article was to talk about their struggles. Part of it was to celebrate what they did so that I and other women like me could be where we are. And part of it was also to show that when we finally were able to get into this space, which took way too long, but when we finally were able to, then it really didn't take long for us to not only like match people, but like sometimes even exceed like the fiscal year 2020 when we were more than 50% of the representation. Even though that's pretty remarkable because there's not as many of us.
That those women work so hard and are so successful. Yeah, I think it's amazing to celebrate that. And again, you know, celebrating women is not about, you know, leaving men behind or not celebrating men. It's simply to say, isn't it wonderful that we can now have people of any gender in the same space doing the same work that you know, your gender's not a barrier.
Yes, and we all have the same opportunity.
Yeah, tell me about Admiral Franchetti.
It was so she wasn't even a part of our original transcript. No offense, ma'am, wherever you are. And then as the editors were asking us to kind of hone down what our thoughts, like what our main point was, I really appreciated them making us focus a little bit more, because not only in that time did the Navy Times come out because she was formally sworn in, but then she had that article that we cited, and yeah. I did not realize that she was supposed to be in a leadership role, but in a non-combatant vessel. And Congress repealed that amendment at that time. And so that shifted the whole course of her life and her whole career, because then she got to go and be assigned a billet on a combatant vessel. And it was so poignant, because I'm like, this is the point we're trying to make, like that when you find when the military find does allow women to do these really neat roles, then we're like groundbreaking, like we're moving forward at a good rate, and being a good example for what equality can look like. And the military is not perfect, and that would not be the message I'm trying to send with this podcast. But I do think that in some ways we're afforded opportunities that aren't always available in other places. And when we're allowed to serve in those ways, then I think it's really neat that we as a community were able to use it really well. And I think that I'm, you know, my little shipboard deployments are nothing like being the CNO, but she took those opportunities that were given to her and then ran with them. And she's our first female CNO, which is pretty incredible.
That is incredible. And, you know, I also was able to hear Vice Admiral Raquel Bono speak at an Association of Women Surgeons conference. But I think, you know, seeing how those women and how you are giving back, and, you know, Dr. Tadlock, to be able to say, you know, how can we help the next generation of surgeons at sea to be prepared for what it's like, and not just surgeons, but all of the team members taking care of patients at sea, you know, how can we help our profession and help others in our profession to be prepared and offer the best care, you know, is not exceptional simply because you've cited all these other amazing people who've done it, but also is exceptional to take that extra time to give back and to try to help everyone else be prepared. So, you know, thank you for being an example of, you know, how amazing it is to have women surgeons thinking about their team and everyone who follows in their wake.
Oh, well, thank you. I was, when I was a resident, people both enjoyed and probably dreaded following me on rotations because my turnover was like 45 minutes long, multiple loose leaf sheets of paper. I'm like, and this is this, and this is this. Like, oh my gosh, it's just, I'll get it. And, but that's just who I am. And so this book is pretty much like my giant turnover, because I just very much want, it doesn't have to be necessarily that it's new for every single person. And so I really hope that it helps people. So does Dr. Tadlock. And he has done, again, he's a very big picture person. So he has done a lot with the maritime and the military surgery community and really kind of pulling in to make it cohesive, because you can write a book and then nothing happens. And so he's kind of the person to keep it going. We really hope that it helps in our careers and careers to come. Even since writing the book and getting it published, things have changed. And so we are hoping for a volume 2 to reflect those changes for the teams. And that hopefully people, because there's the different authors of the different types of people on ships, that there's ownership and buy-in, so that they're not just like, oh, it's a bunch of surgeons talking, but that it's for everybody. Which I think is, everyone can be a team player like that, but I do think that that is a strength that women tend to have more of. And so that's a strength that I've always had. And so it's nice to have used it for something.
Well, I really enjoyed hearing a little bit about the history of women surgeons in the Navy. And I know that there's so much more. And so I hope that everyone will read your article and look for your book. And thank you for your service to our country.
Oh, thank you for your support, ma'am. And thank you so much for this interview. And I hope people enjoy the article.
Thank you for listening to the Journal of the American College of Surgeons Operative Word podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, spread the word on social media by using the hashtag JacksOperativeWord. Subscribe to the Operative Word wherever podcasts are available, or listen on the American College of Surgeons website at facs.org/podcast.